It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The use of psychiatric medications to treat children and young adults has long been a subject of debate among health professionals as well as parents. This Friday, Dr. Sharna Ulfman, a professor of developmental psychology at Point Park University, will present her new book, The Science and Pseudoscience of Children's Mental Health, in conjunction with a new film by Kevin Miller titled Letters from Generation RX. The book examines the issue of using psychiatric medications to treat developing brains, but also reveals the latest sciences regarding the treatment of the disorders that are appearing in children with increasing regularity. Dr. Ulfman joins us in Studio A. Welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
I'm very glad to be here.
The title of the book is The Science and Pseudoscience of Children's Mental Health. What do you mean by the term pseudoscience?
Okay. So just to reiterate something that you've already mentioned, there's been a tremendous spike in the number of children who are currently being diagnosed with psychiatric disorders. As many as 1 in 6 today are being diagnosed and medicated. The pseudoscience is the idea that chemical imbalances are at the source of psychiatric disorders. There is actually no research to support that any psychiatric disorder is caused by a chemical imbalance. And this is, it's not just mental health professionals outside of psychiatry who are distancing themselves from this theory, but it's also psychiatry itself that is distancing itself from this theory. So, for example,
but we hear it all the time.
Exactly. You hear it all the time. You know, it's such a pervasive attitude. You're absolutely right. But even Thomas Insel, who is the director of the National Institute of Mental Health, so he's arguably the most influential psychiatrist, the most important psychiatrist in the U.S., has claimed in his NIH blog posts that the chemical imbalance theory is really kind of last century thinking.
The book focuses on the environmental influences that can affect the developing brain of a child or young adult. What have you discovered to be the most prevalent?
What I would want to say is that, generally speaking, we have dramatically altered children's environments. So, you know, the kind of the old thinking is we're going to find the gene that's causing the chemical imbalance. But this trend, this increase in psychiatric disturbance, is only a few decades old. But genes take thousands upon thousands of years to evolve. So it makes more sense to look at the ways in which we've changed children's environments. So this includes, for example, the fact that we put tens of thousands of chemical toxins into our environment, 1,000 of which have already been identified as brain toxins. So that would be one example. Kids are sitting in front of screens for anywhere from 5 to 8 hours a day as opposed to playing outside in natural settings. We've radically changed the way kids eat. They no longer eat food that we recognize that would, you know, fall from trees or be grown in the soil, but they're eating processed foods that are created in
laboratories,
exactly. So if you and we've changed children's school environments. So now they're doing a lot of rote memorization for standardized tests as compared to the 70s and 80s, where it was all about experiential learning. So we've really changed every facet of their environment. And this...
And you're saying these are detrimental changes?
These are all very detrimental changes. And there's a relatively new science called the science of epigenetics, which shows us that environments impact gene expression. You change the environment, it changes the way genes express themselves, and that in turn changes the way the brain develops. So it's no longer, you know, what is the cause of children's mental illnesses? Are we looking at environments or are we looking at genes and brain development? We really have to look at the integration of the two, how environments impact genes, which in turn impact the way the brain develops and the way the brain functions.
Why have the number of mental health cases in children increased? And what are the statistics from the last generation to this one? Because if what you're saying is that there are more detrimental influences out there, then what was happening before when we saw mental health cases in children in the past? What was causing that?
Right. Well, that's a very good question. And so the first thing I want to say is whenever we look at, you know, what we call mental illness, we have to understand that it's very, very complex and that we have to move away from, you know, these very, very specific labels like ADHD, like depression, and understand that even you take something like ADHD, there may be 20 different reasons why any one child might be hyperactive or have, poor attentional abilities. We're not going to find the magic bullet cause and the magic bullet cure. But I would say that one of the reasons for the dramatic spike that, you know, to the extent that it is a real change in numbers and not just that we're, now diagnosing healthy kids who shouldn't be diagnosed. But I think that the real change is a result of the ways in which we have altered children's environments. I think that we will find that that is at the source of this dramatic rise in children's psychological disturbances.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are talking with Dr. Sharna Ulfman. She's a professor of developmental psychology at Point Park University, and her new book is The Science and Pseudoscience of Children's Mental Health. You say that there is new science behind the idea of epigenetics, that genes impact our environments. And you might have already addressed this, but if not, can you explain for those who may not know what the term epigenetics means, what your new findings are?
So the term epigenetics simply means that, you know, a simple way of understanding it is that in the past we used to think that if we liken it to a play, that the gene is the director of the show. You know, the gene determines, what we look like physically, what kinds of psychological characteristics we possess. But now
it's the director and the art director and the writer and the producer.
Correct. Whereas now we think of genes more as ensemble players. They are one of many influences that determine how we develop and how we grow. Now we understand that environments can actually switch genes on, switch genes off, and depending on how they impact gene expression, this in turn can very much impact brain development. It's also important to understand that the human brain develops, you know, it starts to develop during fetal life, and it continues to develop for 21 years. So when we change environments, which change genes, which change brain development, we especially need to be aware of the formative environments in which our children are growing up.
Sometimes we hear people say that they are afraid to pass on their genes, that they are in some way genetically flawed, prone to depression or mental illness, and for that reason, do not want to have children. Are genes passed along so effectively that a children's genetic impulses and emotions might mimic those of the parent or maybe a generation before, the grandparents?
Right. I think that's a very, very powerful question. And what I want to say, when it comes to psychological traits, the influence of genes is far more complex than it would be for, let's say, something as simple as hair color or eye color. And I think that it would be fair to say that parents are not going to pass along in a very simple way that they have the gene for depression or the gene for schizophrenia or the gene for bipolar disorder, and they're going to pass it along to their children. I think it's far more complex.
So the mental genes are more complex than the physical trait genes.
Far more complex. And I think that what's more important and what a parent is more likely to pass along are perhaps the environmental contexts in which they grew up, that they then follow through with their children. So it might have more to do with their parenting style, or it may have to do with something more complex like their own pessimism or optimism about life that they are passing along to their children. Or it might have to do with their diet, or it might have to do with how they entertain themselves or how much they read and so on, that these are sort of softer traits that are not gene-specific that parents might pass along to their children that might impact their child's mental health.
Have your findings or findings made by other researchers altered the way that doctors or physicians have chosen to treat mental health issues in children?
Clinical practice has not kept up with the research. So in my own practice, my attitude is that I want to move beyond, you know, traditional psychotherapy, and I have interest and questions about, you know, my patients' diet and their lifestyle choices and how much time they spend staring at screens and how they socialize and whether they've had significant exposures to lead or mercury or pesticides. I think that clinical practice really needs to take a more holistic approach, looking broadly at all of these very significant environments and not just narrowly either at, you know, from a psychotherapy approach or from a, well, let's just, you know, use medications and put a Band-Aid over the symptoms.
Your book also contains research concluding that 21st century parents may not realize the influence that cell phones and other mobile devices have on the state of their child's mental health. How does a cell phone alter a child's mental health and development? I think one of the things that comes up with this is how it affects your socialization, that
right.
You might be less prone to interact with people because you're more entertained by your cell phone.
Right. You know, we can look at the research that suggests that, you know, each time with a cell phone glued to your ear is not good for brain health. But I want to focus on not so much the child's use of the cell phone, but the parent's use of the cell phone, especially when a parent is looking after an infant. What we have come to know is that something as simple as the amount of time that a parent spends gazing into their infant's eyes and the eye and the infant gazing into the parent's eyes is a very, very important environmental stimulus that improves the attachment, the relationship between the mother and the infant, and improves brain development. And I have concern with parents who may be glued to their cell phones, texting or talking, and not really connecting with their infants and with their young children's to the extent that they should be.
So are you saying that parents should disconnect when they're with their children? And if so, how do they go about doing that if they're so tethered to these devices
right.
all the time?
Right. It's really just a question of priorities, you know, whether you're mother or father or a, you know, caregiver in a daycare center. That should be your number one priority, and everything else should take second place. So there's a difference between an emergency call and just sort of using a cell phone as entertainment. Because, you know, infants are very, very entertaining, and they should really be the center of your attention. Also, you're modeling problematic behavior. If you want your kids to be sociable and not tethered 90% of the time to their technologies, then don't model that when they're young.
Your book launch this weekend is in conjunction with a new film by Kevin Miller titled Letters from Generation RX, which is a follow-up to a previous film that condemned our youngest generation as both highly medicated but forced to comply to or with extremely narrow treatment options. How can the implications of your findings be applied to the modern mental health field as a whole? And how do your findings change the way we see psychological disorders in young people?
Well, I think that it's really essential that we let the public know that the chemical imbalance theory is not supported. And the primary justification for psychiatric meds is that they will correct a chemical imbalance. And this is simply not true. We don't even understand the underpinnings of psychological disorder enough to, you know, to make such specific connections between chemical imbalances and psychiatric meds. So I think that the public has a right to know that at best, psychiatric medications can address symptoms, can perhaps provide symptom relief, but they are not correcting an underlying illness in the way that insulin is addressing diabetes, or an antibiotic is addressing a bacterial infection. So I think that we need to move away from the chemical imbalance theory as being the center point of mental health treatment, and we need to move towards an epigenetic understanding of clinical treatments.
Our guest has been Dr. Sharna Ulfman, a professor of developmental psychology at Point Park University. This Friday, she will present her new book, The Science and Pseudoscience of Children's Mental Health, in conjunction with a new film by Kevin Miller titled Letters from Generation RX. Sharna Ulfman, thank you so much for being with us on Essential Pittsburgh.
It was a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
And more Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Can a children's game truly lessen the effects of traumatic experiences? A new application developed by Allegheny General Hospital and the Entertainment Technology Center at CMU targets 8 to 12-year-olds who are struggling with traumas ranging from the death of a loved one to domestic or community violence. The goal is to give them a chance to practice the coping skills they've learned in a therapist's office and alleviate the negativity that could lead to larger issues later in life. Dr. Judith Cohen is one of three doctors to develop trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy and was involved in the game's creation. She joins us now in Studio A. Dr. Cohen, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks.
Where did the idea for this come from?
Well, we had a meeting with several mental health professionals and computer experts at a retreat several months ago, and the idea of disruptive technology came up and how this could be used to further help children who were impacted by trauma.
Take us inside the game. Describe what the game allows the player to do.
I am not a computer person, so I can just describe what the experience is like. I can't tell you anything about the computer technology, but basically, this is meant either for kids to use themselves or for therapists to use with kids while they're implementing trauma-focused treatments like trauma-focused CBT. So it's really fun, and the kids start the game as a player who's on the savanna in an African jungle, and different animals work with the lion, who's the king or queen of the jungle, coming with different unhelpful or inaccurate thoughts about what other animals are doing or thinking or feeling. And the lion helps them sort out their experiences to have more helpful or more accurate thoughts. So their feelings and their behaviors are more helpful and productive, and they get along better, and they're happier and more productive and with their interactions.
So the skills that the players are practicing through the game's storyline, leadership, empathy, that kind of thing?
Well, it's really a way of helping them become more aware of how their thoughts may impact on their feelings and their behaviors. So it's really, first of all, thinking about their thoughts. The technical word for that is metacognition. So being aware that they have thoughts that may not be helpful or accurate, and then figuring out what a different thought might be and how that might be more helpful or more accurate to impact their feelings or behaviors.
And how can they apply these skills or these methods to both their adolescent and their adult life?
So often kids who have difficulties related to trauma have unhelpful or inaccurate thoughts about their traumatic experiences, but this goes beyond that. So we know from research that people who have depression or anxiety are often plagued by inaccurate or unhelpful feelings. Inaccurate or unhelpful thoughts, and those impact on their feelings and their behaviors, how they interact with other people, how they for example, go to a job interview, or how they might not even try to apply for a job interview because they think, oh, I'll never succeed, or other people don't like me. And they misinterpret things that happen in their daily lives. For example, if somebody doesn't wave to them from across the street, just to take a very simple everyday example, instead of thinking something benign like they didn't see me, they'll think they're dissing me, or they're intentionally ignoring me or something. And you can see how that might lead to negative feelings and negative behaviors. So the next time they run into that person, they'll intentionally ignore that person. And that can lead to a cascade of negative feelings, behaviors, and we often see this with people who have mental health or substance abuse issues, that they can be quite negative down the road. On the other hand, in contrast, when children or adolescents, or their parents for that matter, learn to question, is this thought accurate? Is this helpful? Could I have a different thought instead that could help me to feel better and act differently, more positively? It opens up a whole new world to them, and they can respond to everyday life events and to trauma reminders or traumatic-related experiences in a much more positive, more healthy way, and that leads to much more positive outcomes for them.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking with Dr. Judith Cohn, one of three doctors to develop trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, and talking specifically about a new application developed by Allegheny General Hospital and the Entertainment Technology Center at CMU, targeting 8 to 12-year-olds who are struggling with a variety of different traumas. How does trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy differ from other behavioral therapies? What mental obstacles are these children living with?
Well, TFCBT, or trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, shares a lot in common with other cognitive behavioral therapies for children. The difference is that TFCBT is specifically focused on children's traumas. But the principles are similar in that it includes skills. It helps children develop skills like the cognitive coping skills focused on in this particular app or game. And it also, one of the differences is because traumatized children have had often many multiple different traumatic experiences, it includes something we call the trauma narrative, in which children develop descriptions of their own personal trauma experiences and then process them or make sense of them using those skills that they've developed through this app. So trying to think about why did these things happen and have the reasoning that I've always thought about, which is, you know, my mother didn't love me, or I'm just unlucky and all bad things happened to me, for example, or it's my own fault that I was sexually abused, those kinds of maladaptive or unhelpful or inaccurate thoughts. Do those really make sense? So changing the way they think about those trauma experiences into more accurate or helpful thinking, really making a different meaning of their trauma experience, is a very central part of this treatment. And finally, we include parents or other primary caregivers in the treatment, so we're really developing healthy attachments or connections between the children or adolescents and their caregivers, and helping to enhance the support that they have with people who will have good and healthy connections with them as they're finishing growing up. And we know that the research shows that effective treatments for traumatized children like TFCBT lead to much more positive outcomes for these children, not only right after treatment, but in the long run in terms of improving their trauma symptoms, but also other symptoms like how they behave, how they interact with other people, how their mood is, and so forth.
And why is it so important that these traumas are addressed at an early age? Why does the game target children?
I'm so glad you asked that question, because we have information from research like the ACEs study that trauma has impact not only how children think and feel, but also on their bodies, on their brains, on their long-term health outcomes. And so we believe, and we're finding new research all the time, that if we can make changes early on in life as soon as possible after trauma impacts children, that we can prevent or reverse these negative impacts on children's immune systems, on their brains, so we can really try to prevent or reverse these negative impacts on their brains and on their bodies. And as the ACEs study has shown, for example, trauma has the potential to have very negative long-term impacts on health, on biology, such as, you know, causing long-term effects like substance abuse, suicidality, even health problems like heart disease, pulmonary disease, and even leading to early death if it's not addressed early. So we hope by having effective early treatments, we can reverse these kinds of negative effects and prevent those really very serious long-term outcomes.
What would you say to people who think children do not benefit from having screens in front of their face, to people who think it actually harms brain development?
Well, I think there is a balance that we want children certainly to have interactions with real people and play outside and engage in athletic kinds of activities and, you know, not just spend all day on the computer. But we do have information that some time on the computer is developing important parts of their brain that, you know, in balance, that's a really healthy and important activity when, again, in balance with social activities and athletic activities and other kinds of activities.
And what improvements have you seen among your patients? What are the early signs that this is successful, this app, this game?
Well, we certainly need more information, more data, but the early information that we have from kids and from therapists is that they like it, that it helps them engage in the cognitive coping part of the treatment, and that therapists really find it useful for helping kids learn this part of the treatment. And anything that can help kids engage in treatment successfully and use it on a regular basis is going to help them use the skill more regularly. So part of any successful treatment is that you don't just go into the office and do it for an hour a week, but that you actually apply it during your day in and day out life when you're out of the office. So one of the things we really like about this app is that if kids like using this this game, that they'll use these skills in between sessions as well, whether it's through the game or thinking about, if something happened with my friend or with my mom in between sessions and they had a negative thought, that they'll think about, wow, I wonder if that thought is accurate or it's helpful. So actually using this skill in between sessions so that it becomes a skill, that it's a life skill, not just a skill in the therapist's office because they like the game and it's engaging them in using that skill, that's really beneficial.
And how do parents access this app? Where is it available, and how can they find it for their children?
Parents or therapists can access the app. It's free of charge. You can download it from the Android or Apple store free of charge. Just type in TFCBT, Triangle of Life.
We've been talking with Dr. Judith Cohen. She's one of three doctors to develop trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy and was involved in the development of a game, a new application developed by Allegheny General Hospital and the Entertainment Technology Center at CMU that targets 8 to 12-year-olds who are struggling with traumas ranging from the death of a loved one to domestic or community violence. Dr. Judith Cohen, thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Coming up, more Essential Pittsburgh. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. This month, the nation will commemorate the 150th anniversary of the end of the American Civil War. On April 9th, 1865, Confederate Army General Robert E. Lee surrendered to Union Army General Ulysses S. Grant at Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia to officially end the four-year war. Although no military battles were fought on Western Pennsylvania soil during the Civil War, Pittsburgh played an important role as the arsenal of the Union. I'm joined now in Studio A by Andy Masick, President and CEO of the Heinz History Center. Andy Masick, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
It's good to be here.
What made Pittsburgh the arsenal of the Union during the Civil War?
You know, Pittsburgh was a manufacturing center at the beginning of the war. It was known for iron. It had started out as a glass town in the early years of the 19th century and then progressed to become sort of the iron city by the time of the Civil War. Not much steel was being made here then. That really comes after the Civil War with the railroad boom that follows the Civil War. But during the war years, Pittsburgh was cranking out tons and tons of munitions from the largest cannons ever cast in the history of the world to everything from caissons and carriages and uniforms and packaged foods and just every imaginable kind of war materiel was made here in Pittsburgh. And then it could be shipped from here down the Ohio River, down the Mississippi. We were connected by rail as well as by canal boats. So this was a hub of activity during the war years and could well be called the arsenal of the Union. And the arsenal that Pittsburgh was best known for was Allegheny Arsenal at 40th Street and Butler.
And you say Pittsburgh was known as the arsenal of the Union, and we certainly understand why. Of course, over the years, there have been companies in the United States that have sold things to the enemy. Was there anything that was making its way from that arsenal down to the rebels?
Well, the people here in Pittsburgh were very worried about their war materiel going south. In fact, even before the guns opened fire at Fort Sumter, the Secretary of War, John Floyd, determined that the big cannons that were stockpiled at Allegheny Arsenal should be loaded up on a ship, and they were going to take them down the Mississippi River to forts in the south. This is before, you know, the guns had really started. And the people of Pittsburgh even then said, wait a second, I don't think it's such a good idea sending all those cannons to southern forts. We don't know how this dispute is going to turn out. And so the people of Pittsburgh actually rushed that boat and scuttled it right there in the Allegheny River. They sent off telegrams to Washington and finally got the order reversed. So all through the war, there were constant fears that Confederate saboteurs might attack the Allegheny Arsenal or some of the other manufactories that lined the rivers here. There were rumors that even incendiaries may have been involved in the explosion at the Allegheny Arsenal, explosion of September 17th, 1862.
Beyond war materiel, how did our region contribute to the Union Army effort?
Well, Allegheny County and Pennsylvania in general provided more manpower than any state in the Union after New York. And the Western territories did more than their fair share. These counties like Allegheny County and the others nearby provided more manpower than counties in the eastern part of the state. When Abraham Lincoln arrived here in Pittsburgh right before he was inaugurated president, he made a speech from the Monongahela House on Smithfield and Water Street. And people shouted out, Mr. Lincoln, will there be war? And he looked across the Monongahela River and he pointed to the south and said, I don't know whether there will be war. It's up to the people of the south to determine. But I'll tell you this, there's no crisis but an artificial one. There's no need for war. And then he went on to say that Allegheny County was the banner county of the Union.
Really?
Because he believed Allegheny County had played a role in helping him get elected. And he was making a political stop here to thank the people of this region for their support.
And although it was a very different Republican Party then, it might have been one of the few times that Allegheny County went Republican.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Today, everyone knows the Battle of Gettysburg as one of the most famous military conflicts in our nation's history. What was the mood in Pittsburgh in the months leading up to the battle?
In 1863, the summer of 1863, the North was in a state of near panic. General Fighting Joe Hooker had been defeated at the Battle of Chancellorsville in Virginia. This was the worst defeat of the Union Army to date. The Army of the Potomac had been crushed by Robert E. Lee and his lieutenant Stonewall Jackson. Jackson was, of course, mortally wounded in that conflict. And Lee determined, along with Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy, that this was the time to invade the North, that the North had suffered this great loss at Chancellorsville. The morale of the Northern people must be flagging, that if the South could win a victory in the North, France and England and other powers might recognize the Confederacy as a legitimate nation, which is what they wanted more than anything. So Lee determined to take his Army of Northern Virginia into Pennsylvania, and they crossed the Potomac and came north. Well, the people of Pittsburgh, just went ballistic when they heard this, and the mills blew their steam whistles. The men put picks and shovels over their shoulders and marched up to the hills surrounding Pittsburgh, and they started building fortifications every place, anticipating a Confederate invasion. But that tells you something about the fear and the concern evinced by the people of Pittsburgh during this period. They felt like the war was on their doorstep.
How did our region contribute to help win the Battle of Gettysburg and ultimately change the direction of the war?
Well, you can make a strong case for Pennsylvania troops playing the lion's share in the Union victory at Gettysburg. But there were other people from western Pennsylvania who participated in important ways. One of them was an Erie, Pennsylvania man by the name of Strong Vincent. And Vincent was a young lawyer, about 26 years old. He became a brigade commander. So Strong Vincent's brigade, made up of Pennsylvania and a New York regiment, were on the extreme left flank of the Union line at Gettysburg.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we're talking with Andy Masick, president and CEO of the Heinz History Center. How has the History Center commemorated the 150th anniversary of the Civil War in Pittsburgh?
Well, when you come to the History Center today, one of the first things you'll see as you enter the Great Hall is a monster cannon. It's the largest cannon ever cast in the history of America. It was made at the Fort Pitt Foundry, which was right on Smallman Street in the Strip District. Well, we made a replica of it, and we've installed an exhibit about the Civil War. You can see it in our innovation section of the History Center. And we've also created a traveling exhibit that's going to more than 30 museums around western Pennsylvania over the next few years. It's about Pennsylvania and Pittsburgh's Civil War. And we built the exhibit around characters. We've made lifelike figures, life castings. So you can see Kate McBride, one of the Arsenal girls. She was one of the victims in the explosion of September 17, 1862. She died along with 78 other young girls and women who were making paper cartridges filled with gunpowder and a lead musket ball. There was an accidental spark that ignited the ammunition laboratories. You'll see Strong Vincent, the fellow from Erie, Pennsylvania that we talked about. you'll see a man who was a color bearer in a Union regiment from Pittsburgh, Jacob Funk. He was killed during the war, but he was one of the heroes of Gettysburg, and he picked up the colors, the regimental flag, when it hit the ground, and then he fought as the color bearer, and we tell that story as well.
It's all fascinating history, and it's all on display at the Heinz History Center. We've been talking with Andy Masick, president and CEO of the Heinz History Center. Andy Masick, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. If you missed any portion of the program or would like to revisit a past segment, you can go to our website at wesa.fm. Until tomorrow, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.